Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for June 3rd, 2011.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
Movement of the seafloor displaces the ocean water above it, and that's what creates the tsunamis.
What we're trying to do is map out the history of the universe.
If it has a dense atmosphere of carbon dioxide, which is a very plausible scenario for a large planet like this, then it will be warm enough to have oceans.
We think liquid water is important for life, at least as we know it.
This week, astronomers have a variety of new tools for identifying planets that could be habitable. We'll tell you how they're deploying them in the search for alien life. And we'll tell you how scientists are mapping the history of the universe with the help of quasars. Also, why your skin could help scrub harmful ozone out of the air. But first, Suzanne answers a listener's question.
Most reports from the recent tsunami in Japan focused on the loss of human life and damage to nuclear power plants in the area. But listener Michael Saltzman of Silver Spring, Maryland, wants to know what happens to the seafloor and sea life during a tsunami.
Movement of the seafloor displaces the ocean water above it, and that's what creates the tsunamis.
He says if there's steep topography on the ocean floor, underwater landslides can be triggered.
In the area of the landslide, it's catastrophic, and anything living in those areas is completely obliterated, buried. In terms of fish in the ocean, of course, if they're up in the water column, they're probably relatively safe. They might not even know what happened. But if there are fish that live near the ocean bottom that feed off the bottom, for example, they would be in harm's way. And also their food supply might be disrupted for a long time in that area. So it would probably cause a bit of a migration just to see if they can stay alive and find something else, you know, to survive on.
He says it could take years for sea life in Japan to recover.
Thanks, Suzanne. If there's intelligent life beyond our planet, we're more likely to detect it from radio signals coming from alien civilizations than from approaching spaceships.
We're trying to answer the question, are we alone? Is anybody out there?
UC Berkeley astronomer Dan Wertheimer, who directs the SETI program, says that in the past, its radio telescopes have surveyed the entire sky for signals.
Maybe ET, if they're out there, are also sending radio or television or navigational beacons, radar signals.
But now, NASA's Kepler spacecraft has identified 86 stars with small rocky planets in the habitable zone.
We pick planets that are very much like Earth. They're small planets, not the big gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn. Maybe they have rocky surfaces. We've also picked planets that are at nice temperatures, that are at the right distance from their star, where they might have liquid water. If a planet is too close to its star, then it's going to be too hot and the water will boil off. If it's too cold, the water will be ice. And we think liquid water is important for life, at least as we know it. So we pick planets at about the right distance where we'd expect liquid water to be.
With information from Kepler, SETI is now conducting a more targeted search.
We're doing the very careful observations looking for radio signals coming from these 86 stars.
He says they'll gather a total of 800 terabytes of data, and it will take about a year for computers around the world to sift through all of it, looking for signals that could be the product of intelligent civilizations.
The simplest thing we look for is a signal that's concentrated a lot of energy at one frequency. It's much like tuning the radio dial across and the signal strength meter goes up at a particular frequency. That's what gets our attention. The problem is we don't know what frequency to look at, so we record a huge chunk of the spectrum and then we comb through it looking for billions of possible frequencies.
If you'd like to lend your computer to the effort, check out setiathome.berkeley.edu. You can download a simple screensaver that crunches data from one part of the sky while you're not using your computer. Next, while SETI is targeting potentially habitable planets for signs of intelligent life, other research focuses on what could make a planet able to support any kind of life. A number of potentially habitable planets have been found, but later ruled out. Justin Warner tells us about the first to clear a major hurdle.
Scientists in France have identified the first planet beyond Earth that could support life as we know it. Many candidates have been found in the past, and you may have heard about some of them. But according to exoplanet researcher Robin Wordsworth of the Laboratoire de Métrologie Dynamique in Paris, this planet, known as Gliese 581d, is the first to stand up to a three-dimensional climate model.
And it turns out, in fact, that if it has a dense atmosphere of carbon dioxide, which is a very plausible scenario for a large planet planet like this, then it will be warm enough to have oceans and hence life.
But Gliese 581d is very different from Earth. For starters, it appears that one side is permanently lit and the other is always dark.
And for a planet that requires such a dense atmosphere to be habitable, it was thought that quite easily you could have a dense atmosphere collapsing altogether on the night side, and hence any habitable climate would be unstable. And we've been able, with this new model we developed, to prove that this isn't the case.
Rather, their model shows that the atmosphere would redistribute heat from the lit side to the dark side. What's more, although the planet receives just a third of the energy from its red dwarf sun than the Earth gets from our sun, Gliese 581d's atmosphere retains that energy more efficiently.
How much warming you get depends on a process called Rayleigh scattering, which is what makes the sky blue on Earth. And if you're around a star like the Sun, then a lot of light gets reflected back to space because of Rayleigh scattering. But if you're around a red star with a red spectrum, then a lot more of that light can get down into the atmosphere, and that makes carbon dioxide a much better greenhouse gas in the Gliese system than it is around the Sun.
Because of factors like these, the planet should be warm enough for oceans, clouds, and rainfall. Wordsworth says their 3D climate model is the best evidence for that we're going to get for the time being. We'll just have to wait for telescope technology to improve so scientists can inspect the planet more closely.
Thanks, Justin. Mapping the universe requires different tools depending on how many light years away the objects are. Astrophysicists have now created the largest map yet made of the ancient universe using light from quasars. Suzanne has that story.
Scientists have created the most extensive map ever of the distant universe, 10 billion light years away.
What we're trying to do is map out the history of the universe.
They've done so by measuring the shadows left by quasars, the brightest objects in the universe, according to astrophysicist David Schlegel of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He says that after the universe formed about 13.7 billion years ago, it started expanding. The force of gravity pulled galaxies together, which slowed it down. But 6 or 7 billion years ago, the expansion started accelerating again, possibly due to dark energy.
That's really the phenomena that we're trying to get at with these maps. So this expansion and now this accelerating expansion, what that has done over the course of time.
He says the map still only covers about 1% of the observable universe, but that's more than was even imaginable just a few years ago.
Thanks for that report, Suzanne. Apparently, household dust has a positive side. This according to chemist Charles Weschler of the UMDNJ Robert Wood Johnson Medical School in New Jersey. Dust is partly made up of dead skin cells, and skin oils contain squalene, a chemical that scrubs ozone out of the air. Previously, Weschler's team found that airline passengers' skin oil helps reduce ozone levels in the cabin. This time, they studied dust from children's bedrooms.
What we found was that squalene in the samples of dust from the children's bedroom was the third most abundant compound that we identified. And there's enough squalene in the dust in these bedrooms to be responsible for about 2 to 15% of the ozone that's typically removed in indoor environments when ozone comes in from outdoors.
Unfortunately, Weschler says you still need to vacuum, since the negative effects of dust outweigh this small benefit. But the findings will help scientists understand the complex chemistry of indoor air. Well, that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll tell you how the sense of smell drove the evolution of large brains in mammals, and how tarantulas keep themselves from falling. Until then, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.